The Assault on American Excellence, a book by Anthony T. Cronman, was the topic of the first talk in Gutenberg's series titled Contemporary Conversations, Part 1. It was presented by Charlie Dewberry on October 2, 2019, at a Gutenberg College community class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2019. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Thanks everybody for coming to our reboot of Wednesday night classes. Charlie's going to speak the Assault on American Excellence, as you can see. I just want to just briefly give you an idea of what our schedule is. This year we're doing something a little different. We're doing every other week Wednesday night classes. They won't be every week this quarter. It'll be every other week. The off weeks we're doing something special for the residents. So we're going to be doing the community stuff every other week, and we will be posting that schedule online, and you can go look at that, and we'll be sending you emails in the mail. So without any further ado, Charlie Dewberry.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris. Tonight I'm going to talk about Anthony Cronman's new book, The Assault on American Excellence. It came out about a month ago, so I've had a chance to look at it. I wouldn't say I've been able to look at it totally in depth, but I understand his basic argument, and I'm going to present that hopefully in a relatively short time so that we have lots of time to interact about the ideas that are in this book. So the first question is, The Assault on American Excellence, what's he talking about? What's the subject of this book? And briefly, what he means by excellence is excellence of human living. And the context for this book is colleges and universities. So first of all, I want to make a few comments about his critique of college and university curriculum. What his critique is not. So first, I want to mention that first, his critique is not about the usual job training and vocation versus the liberal arts. It's not even a concern here because vocational training doesn't really have much of anything to do directly with the question of what's the excellence of human living. So in his mind, we're not talking about the college and university at large. We're only talking about the departments within the college and university that would deal with a question like human excellence. What does it mean to live well? What does it mean to be human? It's those departments and those courses that he's interested in. So as he sees it, there's an assault on the humanities, if you will, and in particular the humanities that are dealing with these kind of questions, meaning of life, what's it mean to be human, what's a good life, what's a significant and meaningful life, those sorts of questions. In his mind, there are three examples that he'll point to that constitute the assault. They are, first, they're in the realm of speech. They're in the realm of diversity, and they're in the realm of what he calls memory, which is rewriting history. So Cronman is a former academic dean of the Yale Law School. He was the dean for about 10 years at Yale. However, his argument isn't that those are the fundamental problems. Those aren't the fundamental issues. That isn't really what's leading the assault on the humanities. And so what I'm going to do in the time I have, first I'm going to lay out his basic argument. And then I'm going to take of those three issues, speech, diversity, and memory, I'm just going to look more carefully at the issue of speech and how he sees speech as assaulting the humanities. So my plan is to present this fairly quickly and leave us time to talk about it, because I think there's some interesting ideas here to talk about and interact with. First, the central tenet of our democracy is equality. And that's not only being highlighted now, it's becoming the all-inclusive principle for our culture. And it's the all-inclusive principle that's driving essentially the humanities at this point in time. However, he points out that the principle of equality is not misplaced, but it's actually destructive when it's directed towards these great questions of human existence. So he's going to argue that that's the fundamental problem, that we want to bring equality into this curriculum dealing with the excellence of human life. And his fundamental argument is that's destructive. And so I'll flesh out why he thinks that's true in a few minutes as we go. But one of the things he highlights first is we don't really totally across the board buy this idea of equality. So at every institution, it's okay for one person to say that one person is better than another person at a skill. Somebody's better at articulating Chaucer. Somebody's a better auto mechanic. Somebody's a better doctor. It's fine. We essentially set the sideboards with regard to equality in such a way as we recognize that, it doesn't include this idea of skills. That it's possible, and we acknowledge, even in our democracy, and even to the extent that we're driven by this equality principle, we see and acknowledge that that's an exception. And we acknowledge that exception. So on that level, it's all right. But yet now, the question is it okay to say one person is a better person than another person? And the answer is fundamentally no. That we don't believe that question is outside the question of equality. We want that to be, and specifically, he's going to show that these modern assaults, the grounds upon which they're making the assault is on the grounds of equality. That because of equality, you can't make these kind of distinctions. So it's interesting, virtually everything is in the equality box except for those differences of skill. And I find it interesting that all the major problems that are of issue, wealth, disparity of power, all of those all originate in the arena of skills. Those are all vocational based. Anyway, I just found that ironic. That isn't a major part of his thesis, but it seems to me that's curious. So, what's his basic, to continue his basic argument, he claims that at this point in time, our principle is egalitarian and we reject any form of aristocracy. And by aristocracy, he means the best, that there's a distinction to be made among people. So the idea that the soul of one person is more developed than another, that's antithetical to the egalitarian principle. That's the fundamental argument that's being made against any form of aristocracy. But Cronman argues that some souls are more developed than others. I mean, education is all about developing the soul, at least it was originally. It's about living the good life. Some people live a better life than other people. this idea and this project goes all the way back to Socrates. That's Socrates' project, is some people live a better life. Some people are more developed in their development of what it makes to make a person human than other people. And we don't like that at this point in time, because that's an assault, if you will. It's an ancient assault on our modern egalitarian principle. So it's just flat out not acceptable. And his argument is fundamentally that's the driver in the humanities at this point in time. So by aristocratic here, he means what it's always meant, meaning the best. So it's about pursuing moral, spiritual, and cultural excellence. And in his mind, this is opposed to the leveling effect of egalitarianism and the tyranny of the majority. How is this opposed? Well, the easiest way for me to think about this is think about a bell-shaped curve. If everything is sort of egalitarian and the majority is going to decide, it's the majority under that bell-shaped curve, it's the majority under that decides what's going to be pursued and what's going to be believed, what's going to be acted upon. And notice the point is, it removes the minor, the excellence at one end and the really bad stuff at the other end. That's largely the egalitarian principle is a foundation of democracy. You're going to avoid the very bad, but it's also going to cost you the very good. You're going to accept, and your political system is going to be driven by essentially that, the middle of the bell-shaped curve. What Cronman is arguing, for the well-being of our democracy, it's essential to preserve a few islands of this aristocratic spirit, both for its own sake and for the good of the democracy. Well, this isn't a new idea. He's not alone in arguing this. I mean, it starts with Socrates. That's the argument Socrates made. In our American history, any of the founding fathers who would have talked about virtue ethics, Washington, Madison, Jefferson, who else shall I throw in there? Franklin. All of them recognized that they're building a democratic form of government, a republic, but whether or not this thing survives is dependent on that there be a culture that cultivates an excellence in virtue. Without that, in their view, our democracy can't continue to function over time. So, an example from history. The first common man elected president, the first president who was not one of the founding fathers or the son of a founding father, was Andrew Jackson. What was Andrew Jackson's platform to get elected? White supremacy and states' rights. Now, I would argue that's not a surprise in a way. If we think back, Madison, Jefferson, all of them had slaves, but you wouldn't see them touting white supremacy as virtuous. They recognize there's a fundamental problem here, but we're not going to essentially make the move to white supremacy. That's a move that would not occur under a virtuous, excellent foundation for the culture. The other person who obviously would agree with him almost in total would be Alexis de Tocqueville. I mean, he's an aristocrat after all to start with. So of course he's attracted to excellence and that sort of thing. But de Tocqueville makes exactly the same argument. And in fact, he was here during the time that Andrew Jackson was president. And he said, what happens here is democracy levels things. It forces people to conform in their ideas and beliefs. It leads to a tyranny of the majority, which is going to result in despotism. The only thing that's an anecdote for this is an educational system that's grounded in this aristocratic pursuit of human excellence. Human excellence needs to be the driver, or this project is doomed for a short lifespan. All of those folks held the same sort of view. What Cronman's saying is, we've abandoned that perspective. And in particular, humanities departments have abandoned that project. So here's his conclusion. It's the faculties of the humanities that gave up their mission for a different agenda. So, and with regard to the three assaults now, I'm going to talk about speech at length, but the other one, diversity, basically his argument is that by pushing diversity, people see themselves primarily as a member of a group, and they're a victim. And his argument is, that's not a very good context to pursue excellence, human excellence. The other one with regard to memory, the goal here is to overcome all prejudices. We're just going to do away with all the prejudices that exist. We're right, and those that lived before us lived in darkness and confusion, and we're rewriting the history. We're taking down the monuments. We're rewriting all of history. So those are basically the points that he makes of how diversity and memory, he's arguing that our perspectives on those right now are resulting in an assault on what he calls the pursuit of human excellence. But what I want to do is look at speech in particular, because speech is going to clarify in much clearer how this mechanism works, I think. And once we see it in speech, we can see he's making a similar argument for diversity and for memory. So let's look at speech. So what's the problematic aspect of speech from his perspective? And on page one, he gives an example. And the example is, the example occurred at Yale. And the day it occurred, he started writing this book. At Yale, the RAs, the resident assistants, or whatever they're called in the dorms, they're called masters. Well, in 2015, a student objected to him being called a master. In this student's mind, this smacked of master-slave. And that wasn't acceptable. He couldn't live under these set of circumstances. So the RA immediately changed his title and, in fact, took it to the president of Yale. And he immediately said, oh, yeah, we need to get rid of this master stuff. Cronman's point is, that's an assault on the humanities and the Socratic project. How does he understand that? Whoops. So I'm going to flesh that out, but to start with, I'm going to give some other examples of the kind of speech he has a problem with, because in his mind, they're all assaults on the Socratic project. The first one, a demand for trigger warnings if something's going to be said that's disturbing. Safe space for protection from upsetting words. Revision of traditional nomenclature to ensure inclusion, like sex, gender, race, all of those kinds of things. And then sensitivity training for microaggressions. All of this stuff, he says, that's an assault on the project. In seminars, here's some examples that he says is an assault on the project. Your views make me feel excluded. You only want to protect your privilege. Speaking as a, and fill in the blank, I see the world in a way you can't. In his mind, it's okay in a seminar to say these things, but these things don't trump the project. And in the project, we're going to see that when you make a claim, you not only have to make the claim, you got to justify why that's true. So in his mind, it's perfectly appropriate in seminars for people to make these kinds of statements. But then we need to talk about whether those ideas are going to trump and determine what can be said and not said and what conclusions can be drawn and not drawn. So what's interesting about Cronman's take, at least to me, is he's not only critiquing the people that want to limit speech on campus, but he's also critiquing the opponents who don't want to limit speech. He's claiming they're both wrong in their arguments. And his point is they fail to see the difference between political speech and campus speech. And I'm going to take a few minutes and talk about that. So political speech, he uses the example of a speaker's corner somewhere where somebody can get up on a podium and say whatever they want. And here are kind of his articulation of this, of political speech. You can come and go as you please. You can participate or not. There's no authority figure. Anybody can get up and say anything they want. There isn't any duty to follow a common theme, so you can have a number of people get up and say whatever they want to say. Doesn't have to be connected to anything anybody else said. And political speech in these kind of corners, it's a debate. It's a debate. But I actually made a mistake here. It's a debate, and it is a contest. The goal is just to get people to agree with you. It doesn't much matter how you do that. And in his mind, this rough and tumble free-for-all, this is our take on political speech. This is how it's done. These are the rules. Now, campus speech in a seminar. He wants to argue, here are the ground rules of what's necessary to pursue this idea of an excellence in education, and to pursue a program in the excellence in being a human. First, you can't come and go as you please, and you may be required to participate. There is a hierarchical structure. The tutor is usually older than the students, and the tutor usually can ride herd to some extent on whether or not something is admissible or not admissible, or whether somebody has justified a claim or not. The central element of this is you're obliged to attain a common conversation, and it's collaborative, meaning the idea is people are going to talk about how they view something, where they differ, and why, and they're attempting to find common ground. It's a joint venture for all of them to come to an agreement. And it demands that all the arguments are warranted by reason. That is, there's public justifications for it, not just personal ones. It's not acceptable to say, well, that makes me feel bad. That's not acceptable in the seminar. And with regard to speech, there's a much higher standard. It's not just whether you're following the theme. It's not just whether you don't heckle. It's not this. But it's actually you're a participant in a joint venture trying to come up with what's true through reason. And the reason is public. And what he wants to highlight is, out of this kind of conversational seminars in this kind of topic, the results are, this is a large part of somehow how the souls of a person get developed. And he said, this started with Socrates. That's what he did. The dialogues of Plato talk about Socrates dialoguing and talking to people and coming up with puzzlements of, this is what we think about this, but wait a minute, there's problems. What are we going to do about this? And if you notice, the Socratic method is, we're going to have this joint collaborative process. We're going to come to a knowledge of what it really means to live a good life. So the conclusions here. Egalitarianism has trumped excellence in the humanities. Our current views of speech, diversity, and memory are all undermining the project started by Socrates. And according to Cronman, this has serious implications for education and the future of our democracy. Those are the comments about the book. I wanted to leave quite a bit of time to either talk about what we think of that, or critique his view, or whatever we want to do, or clarify whatever we want to try to do. I'm not sure I'll be able to clarify everything. As I say, I've read through the book, but I wouldn't say I've totally got it down yet. It's only been out about a month. Yeah.
Thank you for the nice presentation, number one. Make two comments. One, I would say that Socrates' project has been, they killed him.
Whenever
he drank the hemlock. So I would say that the undermining is nothing new. It's been starting since day one. So I'm not sure if it's getting better or worse. It's always been undermined.
Well, but
virtue is not something that's a popular activity,
right.
I would ever argue.
Right, but in an earlier book, he argues, but if you look at Harvard and Yale at the beginning of the American experiment, his seminar was how all the classes were taught, and it was fundamentally about virtue. It was fundamentally about what it means to be human. That's what the programs were. And so his point is, we've abandoned that project. Harvard, Yale, they've totally abandoned that project.
Yeah. I just wonder, this cultural shift, it's happening and has been happening with the consent of a great number of aristocrats. They're on board with this movement. So I don't know, I'm curious about if anybody has any insight or commentary about that, because we couldn't have come here as a society, I don't believe, if it wasn't with the support of our aristocracy. So it seems like there's a division, and that you have some old guard there that are resisting this change or critical of it, and then you have these, a lot, apparently they're even stronger, that are saying, no, we're going to change. We're going to change our values. So I kind of am like, I don't know.
What's his definition of aristocrat?
An aristocrat just means a hierarchy, that that a person is better than another person in some sense. So, for example, go back to the slave master thing. Let's go back to that for a minute, that incident that opened the book. What did he object to in that they capitulated on the term master? What Cronman argues is what he should have told the student was, well, you heard the term master, but what you thought master meant was a southern plantation owner and you are a slave. If he was mistaking the RA for a Mississippi plantation owner, then we have a real problem about what was at stake. And so his point is, he should have been told that the word master here isn't, the context for that isn't the master slave of a southern plantation, it's a master apprenticeship program. That those two things are different. Now, just a second. Now, he's not objecting to the feeling. The feelings can be very real and right. But what he's objecting to is that essentially just because this leads to these kind of feelings with you, that means end of conversation. This has to be done away with. There's no other conversation to be had. He's saying that's not an acceptable move, especially in a university of higher education. Gary.
What I really found interesting about your presentation, the point he made, was this difference between, in speech, between expressing your feelings and saying things which are part of public discourse. It's kind of like, on the one hand, you have a solipsistic attitude where I am kind of the center, and how I feel determines not only what I can say, but what I can hear. And that violates basically what speech is, which is a public enterprise.
Right.
Meanings are public, not private. And when you violate that tenet of speech and try to drive something which is essentially public, including public discussion, and reduce it to my solipsistic sense, you've broken.
Right.
You've basically broken the social contract, which includes speech.
Right.
It doesn't work.
Right. That's half of it. The other half of it is, though, notice that he says in political speech is not a conversation. The seminar is a conversation. It's aimed to come to some kind of, it's a group venture to come to some conclusion about what's true. And so what he's saying is, the opponents, that this is a dichotomy that needs to be made in addition to the one you're making, is there's a distinction between political speech, what it's for, how it works, and campus speech. And we're using the model of political speech as well. So that's the second element of his critique. Yes.
Where people are yelling past each other.
Right. And it doesn't matter, because in the political arena, all it counts is whether you win or not.
I hear that every day on TV.
Charlie, there has been, I think there is discussion in our culture about wanting political speech to be more like the seminar, right? Like, the only way that we're going to be able for our culture to move forward is if we're able to kind of have a discussion where we're looking for truth and looking to kind of find common ground and those sorts of things. That seems to be a little bit at odds with what he's saying, that like isn't the pragmatism of political speech also a problem, or how is he thinking about that?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, and it's a very interesting question, because the way, well, at least the way I read the book going through, and I think it's his perspective. All he's saying is, this is our take on political speech. This is how it's done. Now, his point is, it was done this way all the way back in the first political, well, not exactly the first one, because Washington could have been made king and everybody would have accepted that. So the first campaigns weren't true. But historians now, there's a whole series of the Oxford History of the U.S., and it's, I don't know, 20 volumes all like this. And the conclusion is, as of today, the absolute worst campaign that was ever conducted in American history was Adams versus Jefferson. Because this is the first time a non-Federalist was going to get elected. And it was by far the most horrific, I mean, character assassination, everything short of assassination was done in that campaign. And so the point is, what he's saying, and remember, he's dean of a law school, okay? So his point is, this is how it's always been done in politics, in America. But what kept it from being what it is today, he would argue, was the core group of people who were always interested in human excellence, and there was enough of them around that they had cultural import, and they had cultural influence way beyond their numbers. And all of the people that he listed, all the founding fathers, de Tocqueville, all of them, that was their perspective. If we don't have this oasis in the middle of this egalitarianism, this project ain't going to last, because the egalitarian principle is going to lead to a tyranny of the mass, the tyranny of the majority, and it's over. The only thing that keeps it going that direction, what fights against it, one of the things about this aristocratic education is it teaches you to think for yourself. It's not about coming up with majorities to get stuff done and conforming to all these views. It's the egalitarian principle sort of forces you towards conformity. And his point is, a large part of this project also teaches you independence, an independent mind and spirit, that then if that core group of people interested and dominated by that pursuit, if they're a part of the conversation about where ought we to be going and why, he would argue that's what made the difference. That's why it's necessary. That's why we need to protect this education within this political egalitarian framework. Is that getting at your question? Yeah, Gary.
As a counter to that.
Okay.
Academics as a whole, as a group in this country, would you say, given that they're the academic aristocracy, that they have reached the peak of education, et cetera, et cetera, would you look to them to guide the culture today?
Would you look to them? Well,
would they be whatever he's saying, they have a special role?
Yes.
If you agree that on the whole, academics form an aristocracy in this country, are you then willing to say that they're in a position to lead or not? I, for one, would say no.
The issue is complicated here, for this reason, is in his view, the purpose of the educational institutions and the original purpose of Yale and Harvard was essentially to turn out mostly people for the clergy or law or go into government service. But the foundation of that program was, what does it mean to live a good life? So it was the Socratic Project. So the Socratic Project, so it's aimed at the individual. It's aimed at essentially maturing individuals. That individuals who go through this program, the thinking is they're going to come out more mature, and they're going to come out with greater understanding. It's going to build their souls.
What I'm asking is, I get that. Okay. What I'm asking is that in fact the case?
Well, not now, and that's his point, is the humanities capitulated on that project eons ago. And especially, and in the last decade or two, especially since 2015, what he sees is all the humanity departments capitulating to this assault of speech. So he's saying they haven't been playing their role. For Harvard hasn't had these kind of seminars as the core of their program for 150 years, probably.
So do we reignite this whole process of generating an intellectual aristocracy, or do we look elsewhere?
But I think you're confusing with getting confused with the term aristocracy, because he seems to be meaning the, like, the best people are
right. Meaning,
and he doesn't, well, no, he means literally, and we use the term aristocracy to mean just...
He's only talking about playing this role in the sphere of education. He isn't saying these necessarily all ought to be the leaders. What he's saying is, but these people have an important role to play in culture that's more important than people who primarily have just done vocational training. That this idea of what does it mean to be a human, and what does it mean to lead a good life, and isn't it true that some lives lived are better than other lives lived? Well, it's just raising that issue, and then again, you're essentially maturing individuals who are then going to go out in the culture at large. It's not an attack on egalitarian at all once they leave. I mean, they can go stand up and go do public speech just like anybody else. They can go to the corner and say what they have to say. So he's not saying they ought to take over and run everything. But he is saying they have a role to play that contrasts with this leveling that occurs because of the egalitarian democratic process. That's what he's claiming. We need those people who are pursuing that goal. That without that, we're going to end up basically conforming and ending up with a tyranny of the majority, and that'll be the end.
We can make danger spaces instead of safe spaces. Warning, yeah. You will be confronted with ideas you may
Chris.
Existentialist philosophy 101.
Yeah.
thanks, Charlie. A question or two for you, just
sure.
Kind of random thoughts that are occurring to me. So this idea of the pursuit of excellence, the pursuit of, what would you say, the meaning of life, so is this, is it just the questioning? And is the questioning in and of itself valuable, or is the arriving at a particular answer valuable? And if it's the arriving at a particular answer, is it possible that the majority of Americans believe they've arrived at the answer to what constitutes a virtuous life and are doing their best to pursue it? We hear about virtue signaling, for instance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Virtue, or at least projecting an image of virtue, seems to be very much front and center. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering whether it's not that the pursuit of excellence has been abandoned, but perhaps the understanding of excellence has changed, and we're now striving to be, you know, as tolerant, as understanding, as compassionate, maybe as humble. I'm playing devil's advocate here. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it almost strikes me as, you know, for instance, when I think about the Middle Ages, I don't think of a bunch of independent peripatetic philosophers going around asking themselves what the meaning of life was. They had it figured out, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone had it figured out. Everyone was pursuing it. And is it possible that today it's more like the Middle Ages, where there is cultural consensus about what is good or virtuous or excellent, and people are pursuing it just as they did back then? And it's not this kind of questioning and peripatetic, Socratic, Platonic, academic uh-huh. type of era, as it were.
Okay. Huge question. lots. But I'll just make two brief comments. First, I think he would say, yes, it is about a pursuit of truth, meaning answers. But these are very big questions which take a long time to answer. But it's also about the process. It's learning the skill of how to address these kinds of questions. As far as today, why does he call it an assault? He calls it an assault because, yes, culturally we all know what's true. We ought to get rid of all these prejudices that were there. Everybody that came before us was ignorant and lived in the shadows. Well, if that's the consensus and nobody is going to question it, he would say that just proves that that isn't the project and has never been the project of pursuit of human excellence and what a good life is. You're just assuming your culture's got it right and we're just going to essentially express that, and we're going to rewrite history in doing it. Well, his point is a little bit of reflection on that and asking for justifications of that kind of perspective is going to lead you to a point where you may not be so sure that you really do have the answers. Is that getting at
yeah,
your question
yeah,
about
so, thank you.
Well, is there something about within an educational or within the academic framework that you're sort of pausing the assurance of the democratic project without trying to topple it, of course, but kind of question, I mean, that's what you do there, is you go and question what exactly is this democratic project, what is it, what are its pros, what are its cons,
right,
to kind of highlight in relief, even if you still believe in it, maybe it's not sort of a perfect system,
right,
and to understand it in within a sort of like within a context, I suppose,
right,
so that you don't become more or less sort of what Chris was going,
yeah,
dogmatic about what the excellence, dogmatic about what excellence is,
right?
It's just yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Charlie, have you read The Closing of the American Mind by Alan Bloom?
Yes.
Is this a similar sort of?
Well, I would say it's in the same ilk.
Okay.
And in fact, a book I may do later, a book that came out the same day this did. There's a guy named John Haight that some of us know because we read his book, The Righteous Mind, as part of the Summer Institute. The day this came out, he came out with a new book called The Coddling of the American Mind, which I think the title kind of places it as well as this. Yes, they're in a similar vein, although there are differences. Cronman's making a different sort of argument, but the critiques largely run this way. I mean, the biggest critique of Bloom's book is he's just an elitist. That's the critique of this. He's just an elitist. That somehow some people are better than other people at being human. How can that be? That's just not acceptable at any level in this day and age. Yeah, Gary.
Yeah, Okay, so he's telling us what was the case, which is no longer the case, which, however, ought to be the case.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay. Now, my question, and I pose this question, if you don't want to go after it, just drop it, but here's the question. Given what is the case, what are our prospects?
For?
Because transforming, going back and implementing the kinds of changes he would like to see, as far as I can tell, you're swimming upstream. And the stream is pretty fast. So given the, you know, given the case that it is what it is, what do we have to look forward to?
Well, I would use a little different metaphor. I would call it spitting into a hurricane. But what I want to say is when we founded this place 25 years ago, that was the project. And as far as I see, we're still here. And we're doing exactly what we thought the project we wanted to do is. And I'm not saying it's exactly the same as what he articulated here, but it's pretty close. There's an awful lot of similarities. Now, are we going to change the world? No, that's not our project. Our project is aimed at an individual. An individual is going to make decisions about life. What leads to a meaningful and significant life? Every individual at some level deals with that. That's what we're dealing with specifically here. And we're still here, and we still have students. And in my mind, we're accomplishing what we set out to do.
I'm glad I came tonight, Charlie, because I have a new picture of how I've spent the last 25 years spitting into her.
But no, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, look at where higher education is and look at how many programs like this exist. And this program is virtually the same as what Harvard and Yale were 150 years ago. This was their project. They abandoned it.
But given that you're rather severely outnumbered, again, my question is, what do we have to look forward to?
A B.A. at Gutenberg.
Well, yeah. Well, but, I mean, are you talking politically? Or are you
culturally,
talking...
Culturally.
Okay, culturally. Well, it depends. Cultures are always on a trajectory to somewhere, and those trajectories change periodically. I mean, maybe we're on a trajectory that's not going to change, and it's going to get really, really bad. Maybe we're on a trajectory, and all of a sudden people are going to go, yeah, you know, mistake's been made. We're going to somehow figure out how to write this thing, and the trajectory of culture and education is going to make a turn. I mean, every 5 to 10 years, education's reinventing itself, right? I mean, every 5 or 10 years, they do it all over again, completely different. Who knows? Maybe. So I don't know. But I guess that's not what motivates me. What motivates me is this is about the people we have in seminar, the people that come that are part of this community. That's our context. That's as far as I'm looking.
Charlie?
Yeah, Ron.
It is. I don't know why I'm bringing this up, because it's the sort of thing that can stir all sorts of things up, and I don't like stirring things up. But
he says.
I've been thinking a lot about some of the things that make our situation very difficult to change. And I've been trying to think about...
In the hour here is...
Not here.
Oh, the bigger
situation
okay.
that he's
yeah.
described.
Okay.
So let's take in the academic community. I think that it's true that things like elitism and power imbalance and those kinds of things, those are realities.
Yes.
That is, and there are many people in our culture who would recognize, you know, my situation in life makes it that I don't get taken as seriously as this person over here, or mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I understand the sort of, I have made this distinction in my mind that, this is a complicated thing, but there's a difference. I reject the notion of power plays. I don't respond to that, you know, you can't use that word anymore and that right. kind of thing. But I feel like we have an obligation to listen to other people's stories. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot about the world and a lot about where different people have, the kinds of lives they've lived, the cultures they've lived in, the problems they've faced, that I don't know a lot about. Mm-hmm. And it's easy for me to think I understand how everything works out there, only mm-hmm. to find out actually maybe, you know, it's a harder world than I understood. And that, so mm-hmm. that's a tricky sort of balance for me. Mm-hmm. And part of what makes it complicated, I mean, I could give as an example, I'm not trying, might as well stir everything up, right? But
sure.
I'm just giving this as an example. You don't have to agree with me about mm-hmm. this perspective, anybody here. But I think that the Bible, on the one hand, I think that the Bible teaches that there is a sexual morality, and there is, as a part of that, that there is a design. I mean, homosexuality is going against the design of God. It's spitting in God's face and saying, no, I like this, and that's where I'm going to go, on the one hand. But on the other hand, culturally speaking, I feel like there is a tremendous amount of mistreatment and self-righteousness that has happened in the part of, on that part of the culture that has not supported that, mm-hmm. where there are stories that are genuinely, I mean, people who have been treated as less than human mm-hmm. because, so on the one hand, I look at it and say, I don't agree with you about the moral issue here, and I resist the power play that would try to make it so I can't say what I think about that. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I don't want to dismiss the idea that you have something to say about how you've been treated and what it is that's going on here. And that's where this kind of a thing to me gets complicated. It's like, because oftentimes people, to me, I feel like people have, in confusion, have conflated two things at the same time. Thinking about me with respect and treating me as a person who is equally deserving of good treatment as anyone else, and agreeing with me about this issue that we disagree about. One of the confusions in our culture is that we sort of wrap those things together.
Right.
So that stuff about the, you know, using the word master and all of that, it gets tricky, because I think the people on that side of things would say, well, it's not just a lexical issue here. It's I have not been hurt.
Right.
And that's what makes it, to me, that's what makes it a challenging. I don't disagree with anything that he said, but I just don't, for myself, I just don't want to be too glib about saying, oh yeah, I know the problem with where you guys are coming from.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Yes. To start with, one of the things he says right in the introduction is, there is a fundamental problem in this country. And the fundamental problem is we have a caste system. And he said, there's virtually three races here. White, Native American, and Black. And we're waiting for all the Indians to either die or get assimilated. So that problem's going to take care of itself. But the Black one is still a fundamental problem. But his point is, we aren't going to solve it the way we've been going by this assault. And essentially, I think he's in a sense making your argument for you, in the sense that what ought to happen, what people ought to be learning how to do, is have a conversation. And in those conversations, you're going to hear all those stories. Somebody is going to say, I'm an X, and the world looks different. Okay. The difference is that doesn't end the conversation. That starts it in his mind. And so that, with that distinction, I think that the problem, at least within the educational system itself, in his mind, how he's picturing that is built on your point.
Yeah, no, I can see that, and it really does concern me that it seems like the academic community is teaching its students that, or at least supporting them in the idea that, as you put it, that's where the conversation starts,
right.
But supporting the idea that you show that you have heard and respect me by ending the conversation when I have spoken.
Right.
And that, I mean, if that's the way we're going to define it,
right.
Then can't get anywhere. I mean, we can't have a conversation because the very act of trying to have a conversation is an act of disrespect. And that worries me.
And that's
worries
the assault.
Me. That worries me. But.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Huh. I just want to say that I had this that happened to me, that very thing you just described, on Lane campus. I was just sitting there in the studying in a room. This is a while ago, like a year ago, and this guy dressed up like he was dressed. What did he have on? Something. He had a dress on. He had a dress on and something else that was like a girl with dress, and he was with this other kid. And I said, "Hey man, why are you wearing that dress?" And where I was coming from, I'm thinking, "Oh, are you gonna be like doing some kind of play or something? Like, you know, is that what you're gonna be doing or something? Like, I don't know, it's kind of funny, you know, that you're wearing that. That's where I'm from. Like, oh, it's kind of, you know, weird. What's going on? What are you doing for the school, you know?" And then he just was like sucked up, was just like kind of shocked that I asked. And then his friend, a girl or a boy, I'm not sure, says, they, you referred to them incorrectly, they, and I'm lost. I'm like, what are you talking about? Literally, this is the first time I encountered the whole they pronoun thing. And it was just like what Ron talked about. There was no conversation to be had, literally. If you don't immediately recognize that you're absolutely wrong, that you're dead wrong, that you're just pretty evil to not recognize my reality. Well, that's a problem, and that's where they're coming from. I just experienced that. That's all I wanted to say. And that's really bad.
Any other comments or questions? Yeah, Trisha.
Well, I was just noticing within this conversation, it's very interesting that I think you were talking about personal definitions versus public definitions. And I think it's interesting that a lot of the definitions are in our culture are being considered by a certain aspect of our culture as emphatically personal. Like, if I decide in the next 5 minutes that I wish to be referred to as he, then I'm suddenly defining myself as a man, and according to certain cultural things, all of you should immediately capitulate and all call me he, because that's what I want. And there's nothing within the public definition, like the public definition of the word has become meaningless, and whatever definition I put onto it because of my feelings immediately become the proper definition that must be used by everyone around me. And looking at where we're going, this could either go somewhere very bad, or one of the things that I also see coming down the wire is potentially we have too much intersectionality, and my personal definition comes up against your personal definition, which comes up against your personal definition, and comes up against your personal definition, and then all the people in here, who are they going to capitulate to when my definition and your definition and your definition and your definition of one word are all different? And it could just be a great big snake that eats itself. That's what I'm hoping for. I would like to say, like, in response and in 5 minutes, when you change your definition of who you are, your previous definition should not be held against you. That's where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 5 minutes, you're like, oh, I'm actually a Zier, not he, not her. You can't hold it against me that I was something else.
Yeah.
Again, with the intersection.
Did you hear about the person that that identified themselves as a hippopotamus? Did you hear that story? I think it was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Go interspecies.
Yeah. The story?
Yeah. It's just, oh, I don't have the full story. I read the headline and it, like, maybe the first paragraph, but I don't remember it that well. It was kind of fun.
It wasn't the engine, right?
No, it was really, I think it was Drudge. One thing. Yeah, there's definitely changes in the academic world, you know. We, if I say us, the right, conservative, traditional values, whatever you want to call it, is losing the battle. And probably against the public in some ways in a mass movement. Jeff's losing the battle. But I would argue that, like, the business world, so far as I've seen, like, I work in nursing homes, and we had a person there who dressed as a woman and he was biological male. He didn't stay employed for very long. He came into work like once, like that, maybe twice, and then he just disappeared. I don't know if they fired him or he quit, he or she, whatever. And there's a lot of businesses that just won't fly with that. You got to, if you're born a man, you got to be a he, and if you're born a woman, you got to be a she. So maybe it's okay in college, you know, maybe it's okay in popular culture, but in the business world still, Not flying. Now, maybe 30 years from now, it might be different, but I can see that. So I'm not 100% that we've lost. And I would also argue that there's a majority of people out there, a lot of people still that hold traditional values, well near a 50% mark in our culture. So, you know, it's an interesting time.
But there's some hope for you.
Yeah, there's some hope, yeah. And Jordan Peterson talked about
that.
Yeah, Jordan Peterson talked about this stuff. He says when we talk about equality of outcome versus equality of the opportunity, which is something we kind of talked about, and about differences between people, and you know, and but anyways, so if anybody's interested in that topic, I would say that we're talking about some very fundamental things here that have been the same question for thousands of years that I can think back. You think, we talk about Socrates. I love the Greeks. God, there isn't much that they didn't talk about, really, that we're still talking about thousands of years later. And I would say that this idea of all this changing identity stuff, whether you're losing like your nationalism or gender and sex roles. First of all, in ancient Greece, there's ample evidence of like homosexuality and boy loving. The older men used to take young men and like raise them up and things. And then they created democracy, you know, in Athens. So they covered a lot of ground. They covered a lot of ground. One of my favorites is Diogenes of Sinope. That guy had it done. And he talked about cosmopolitanism. I am a citizen of the world. And I see kind of like it's heading in that direction right now. That we're losing that nationalism in our country, at least. There's a movement now to do that, all these kinds of values, and to have this open idea of what is virtue, not necessarily one solid framework that is, you know, the universal ultimate one truth. A lot of people don't agree with that, and I can kind of see why. I see both. You know, I have my own one truth that I identify with. I think most people do, and we come together because probably most of our truths are similar. And we get attracted to each other in these groups. So, I mean, to me, but that's the way it's always been. It's always been that way, you know? And maybe some thing in culture is changing, the popularity contest, the sort of superficial thing is changing, but ultimately the same rules, I think, underneath are still there, deep. And it's deep in our nature. Hierarchy is biological. We know that. It's not going to go away because of some cultural movement. It's in us. And I think that, you know, you can change the decorations, but the cake is still the same. You know what I mean? So that's what I argue.
Anything else? Other comments or questions? Well, thanks for coming and being part of it.
Thank you.